Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 619, interview with Paris Flamand on the anniversary of President Kennedy's assassination. This is being recorded on November 18th of the year 2007. Once again, it's my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airwaves Paris Flamand, the author of, among other titles, The Kennedy Conspiracy in 1969 and the just-released four-volume series, The Assassination of America, about the assassination of President Kennedy. Paris, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thank you very much, Dave.
In side one, near the end, we were dissecting some of the official nonsense, because that's what it is, about the assassination of President Kennedy, and you were pointing out that there are very significant and many significant discrepancies with regard to the reality as it can be determined of the murder of Patrolman Tippit and the official version of that killing, which attributes that as well as the murder of President Kennedy to Lee Harvey Oswald. Inside two, I'd like to, and bearing in mind that in this interview we can only throw a few well-aimed darts at the official version, because there is such, it is such a vast tissue of lies, which is really what it is, that we just don't have the space here to pick it apart. But in your four volumes, you do that and more. Let's try to familiarize, though, someone who might be much younger than us, or someone who simply has not become familiar with the facts. The two low-nut assassins of November 22nd, 1963, Jack Ruby and Lee Harvey Oswald, were very different than what the official version has them as being. Let's start with Jack Ruby. Tell us a little bit about who he was and what the significance is of what Jack Ruby was to understanding the story.
Well, curiously, the confluence of events in my life have put me, or did put me, in an odd position regarding some aspects of this book. One was I had already known a great deal and done research into the history of the old Catholic Church, and another was that I went to school in Chicago. And during that time, I frequented a drugstore, a pharmacy, which had gambling in the back. This was not uncharacteristic of places like that in Chicago in those days. And the owner was a fellow that, to me, was just a rather hail fellow, well-met fellow named Jimmy Weinberg. He had a friend who was there from time to time, whom I found much less comfortable to have in the general vicinity, whose name was Paul Labriola, Paul Needlenose Labriola. Well, I subsequently learned that these two were part of the Chicago Sunday Poverty, Jake the Greasy Thumb Gusick group in Chicago. And one of the people I learned much later, I didn't know it at the time. As a matter of fact, it was not until I started investigating the assassination that I discovered that there was a Jacob Rubenstein that used to come and visit Jimmy Weinberg, and he had subsequently changed his name to Jack Ruby. He was apparently no more than a runner for the people in the Gusick entourage, or for Jimmy. Jimmy had gone down to Texas in 1948, to arrange for expansion of syndicate activities down there. And apparently he took Jacob Rubenstein with him, and who became Jack Ruby. And when Jack Ruby sort of separated himself from that arm of the syndicate, he went to Texas and went to Dallas and bought a nightclub with his wife, and then subsequently another nightclub, and developed into a well-known aficionado of the police force and of the shadier elements of that city, and a time when almost all of it was pretty dark. And so it was an odd sort of evolution of circumstances that I should have probably saw him or bypassed him or something when I was still in school, when I went to see Weinberg. And, of course, might equally well not have, but there was that proximity, and it struck me in years later how fortunate I was not to have gone to Dallas or whatever in those 40s, days of the late 40s.
Jack Ruby has been portrayed as, quote, a Dallas nightclub owner. In fact, he was much more than that. A good overview of Jack Ruby's many organized crime connections, Seth Cantor's biography of Ruby's an excellent one, and also Peter Dale Scott's Deep Politics and the Death of JFK goes into Jack Ruby's long history, and it would not just organized crime, but the narcotics trade, and how that in turn overlaps the mob's activities in Cuba and the CIA's subsequent activities in Cuba as well.
Yes, well, certainly he had maintained a connection with the Chicago mob, and he had connections with the Carlos Marcello branch over in New Orleans. On the other hand, of course, he didn't have to reach very far because Marcello's reach was all the way to Dallas. His territory covered New Orleans and then westward to Dallas, where it didn't have an independent capo in those days. I don't know if it has in recent years, but so he was in the general within the general parameter of Marcello's sway, and yet always kept contact with the Chicago people. It's interesting, of course, that Guy Bannister was also from Chicago and almost certainly knew of, if he didn't actually know, Ruby there.
One of the things that unites Jack Ruby and the world of Lee Harvey Oswald, and that is the activities that were conducted against Fidel Castro in the late 50s, and in particular in the early 1960s. Jack, or the aforementioned Carlos Marcello, employed a guy named David Ferry as a pilot and investigator. David Ferry was also employed by Guy Bannister, who was a former FBI agent, New Orleans police official, and ran a detective agency, which was an intelligence front. And not only did that Guy Bannister detective agency represent the intersection of people like David Ferry with Carlos Marcello, but also Lee Harvey Oswald figures in there, and in a way, that address, the 531 Lafayette Place, 544 Camp Street, is a good jumping off point, perhaps, to explore the realities of Lee Harvey Oswald, who he was, who he wasn't, and what he was and what he wasn't. Let's do a little bit of that before we talk about Jim Garrison's investigation per se. 544 Camp Street, 531 Lafayette Place, and the creation of the legend of Lee Harvey Oswald, the lone nut communist assassin.
Well, of course, that's on a corner. I assume it's still there, a stone building that, as you say, 544 Camp Street, and then around the corner is 531 Lafayette. And Oswald and Ferry, and by the way, I might mention that my book has pictures of a number of pictures, I don't know, maybe a dozen, of Ferry's apartment, where I went with a couple of Jim's assistant DAs and Richard Popkin, the critic, one day, 40 years ago, and the office which was subsequently found ammunition and weapons was undoubtedly an outlet for anti-Castro activity, plus other probably just straight out criminal activity. Bannister, as you had said, had been a Chicago FBI man, and he had gravitated to New Orleans after losing that position, and he was for a short time with the police force down there, but he got in trouble, and so was released, dispatched from the New Orleans police force, and set up his own private detective agency. He was apparently a rather brutal man, prone to heavy drink, and yet able to keep his hand in to all sorts of nefarious activities for a number of years, and not the least of which was certain aspects of American intelligence. And probably that was mostly with respect to the anti-Castro efforts that were going on at that time. Oswald, Ruby was very anti-Castro. Oswald is completely enigmatic on that, because sometimes he was pro and sometimes he was anti and sometimes he had no political position on the question at all. So one of the supports for the idea that he actually was not as dumb as he seemed and was cleverer than most people credited him with, namely that he was working for at least two different of the American intelligence agencies at the same time, maybe more. As you know, it's not uncommon for major American intelligence people to work for more than one organization at a time. I mean, NASA quite often has somebody in the CIA, for example. So the whole story of 544 Camp Street is really almost worthy of a book in itself. So much went on there, more than we probably ever will know. But it certainly revealed Bannister to be a player in this entire scenario.
Indeed, and Lee Harvey Oswald was, according to various, it depends on what part of the official version one wants to give credence to,
yes,
but a lone nut who defected to the Soviet Union with top secret information about our radar nets and the U-2, then came back, was never debriefed, let alone prosecuted by FBI or CIA.
He did come back.
He did. Oh, eventually he came back. And
I mean, if it was him.
Yeah, he then began keeping interesting company for somebody who supposedly was a pro-Marxist traitor. He started hanging out with...
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, in the book I have, I believe there's one page I have 30 headshots of him over a period of about 10 or 12 years. And I defy you to say they're all the same person.
And not only that, but there were people identifying themselves as Lee Harvey Oswald around the American Southwest,
right,
establishing what the intelligence community calls a legend, while Oswald was still officially in the former Soviet Union.
Very true.
One of the aspects of the Kennedy conspiracy, which is then reinforced in Assassination of America, that helped to open my eyes, and that was your work with Jim Garrison, and you worked very closely with former New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison. And as I mentioned in the early part of our interview, the House Select Committee on Assassinations ultimately wound up vindicating Jim Garrison. Tell us about Garrison's investigation. How did it take shape, and what do you consider to be the major focus and the major significance of his investigation for history, and this from someone who worked closely with him?
Well, I'll precede just a little bit the how that was initiated. I had this friend Eric Norden, who wrote did the superb interview of Garrison for Playboy magazine back in October of, I guess that was 68 or 69, and then subsequently wrote the first, or not subsequently, previously had written the first really intellectual analysis of the assassination for a minority of one. It came out just a couple of weeks after the assassination, as recommended to anybody who really wants to understand what was happening at the very beginning. Excuse me. And so he called one day, and he said that he had this assignment from Playboy to go down and interview, I should have said parenthetically, we'd been friends for some time, and I had put him on the air that I was on a radio show I was producing at, during those days. And he said he was going down for Playboy to do the interview of Jim Garrison, this district attorney who was raising so much hell with everybody down there. And why didn't I get an assignment to go along and do something similar, maybe Argosy or Saga or some other publication? So I called my agent and said, told him what the situation was, and he said he'd get back to me. He did in about an hour, and he said, I'm very sorry, I can't find anybody who will put up the upfront money. Several magazines are interested, but they, you know, they won't go for the grand upfront to pay for expenses. And I said, well, that's all right, because I was literally in the middle of another book called The Age of Flying Saucers, and I was only about a quarter of the way through. So he said, no, I don't mean to be all negative. I couldn't get you a magazine article, but I have got you a contract for a book on Garrison. Nobody's done it. And I said, that's great. He said, but can you do two books at one time? Well, I need to hardly tell you that no author ever says he can't do two books at one time if it's offered to him. So I guaranteed him I could. And I called Eric Nordenback and said, let's go down to New Orleans and meet Jim Garrison, and you do your thing and I'll do mine. And so we did. I met Garrison, and he was extremely friendly and hospitable, and I think we were there only two nights, and he took us out to Brennan's, and Eric had to get back. He did his interview, and he had to get back to New York. And I stayed for a while, and Jim was interested in the fact that I knew a good deal about the old Catholic Church. And then he asked if, that was after I came back to New York. When I came back to New York, he called and asked if I'd ever heard of Permadex, and I said no. He said, well, it's a European operation, and you can find out more things in New York than I can in New Orleans. Would you look around? And I said, absolutely, and I did. And I gave him a lot of material on Permadex and the Centro Mondiale and the newspaper clippings, and had a lot of stuff translated for him and analyzed as much as I could. And also gave him information about the old Catholic Church, of which David Ferry claimed he had been a bishop. In point of fact, he was never even ordained, hadn't even been an acolyte. He had just heard about the sect apparently, and decided that he wanted to be a cleric, and he chose that one. And there were a number of other people in the case that were affiliated one way or the other with the church or with a like religious operation.
We should interject at this point, by the way. We've got a little less than 10 minutes left in the interview, but this is not the Catholic Church. This is a relatively obscure sect which has gone under a number of different names, and as you point out, its prelates appear to favor long-winded titles, and it looks as though this old Apostolic Roman Catholic Church, as it's sometimes called...
Yes, well, it has about at least 10 different names, of course. There are 10 different schismatic bodies.
It appears that basically this organization, though, has been used as something of a vehicle, a front, not unlike Centro Mondiale Commerciale and Permandex, and that these intelligence and sub rosa political activities overlap the activities that were going on in New Orleans that Jim Garrison was investigating.
Well, actually, the church itself is most of the bodies, as I say, there are a number of different, quote, churches, unquote, most of them are gay. And probably have little or nothing to do with anything political or in terms of intelligence. There undoubtedly are one or two people who have used it as a cloak, and I won't go into their names now because they don't really apply to the book. But in general, the Old Catholic Church is bizarre, gay, and has now practically no population whatever. 20 years ago, it had a listing of something like 130 churches in the Almanac. Today, it's not listed at all. So, although if you go on the internet, you will be able to find various, quote, bishops, unquote, who are still presiding.
What sort of put Garrison on to his investigation was noting that Lee Harvey Oswald, the supposed pro-Soviet, pro-Castro, Marxist-Leninist defector, was in fact hanging out with anti-Castro Cubans, aerospace industry high rollers, people involved with covert actions against Castro, and people who did classified work for the United States Army, like Jagger's Charles Stovall.
Yes, and, right. Particularly him.
And so in particular, this Garrison noted this, you've got a commie who supposedly killed the president hanging out with a bunch of dyed-in-the-wool anti-communists who hated the president, and that set him on his investigation. Tell us a little about that.
Well, it's something very interesting. Most people, I don't realize, unless they knew Jim or were there at the beginning, about the only people that were Dick Popkin and Bill Turner and a couple of others, Eric Norden. Originally, Jim thought that Oswald was involved, but that he was not the lone assassin, and that he had been a participant with at least three or four other people. As the time went by, he began to decide, no, he wasn't an active participant in the usual sense, but he had been a patsy and had been suckered into this operation, but he knew what was going on. Finally, he decided that, no, he'd been used completely, and he had no idea what was going on, and he wasn't involved at all. So he went through this transition. As he interviewed more and more people, and of course he interviewed scores, if not hundreds, of people, and he evolved. He did not have a concrete, irreversible position. He was completely flexible. He just wanted to know, and the more he learned, the more he modified or reevaluated his analysis of the situation, and he came ultimately to be convinced that Oswald had absolutely nothing to do with it, and that various etc. He had very I mentioned in the book, but it's so complicated to go into various other possible actual shooters and motivators, but ultimately it was always that they were just that. The real assassins went way up high in the echelon of our society.
And again, Jim Garrison's investigation was vindicated to a considerable extent by the House Select Committee on Assassinations, which recommended that the Department of Justice investigate David Ferry, and also suggested that Clay Shaw might very well have been either a cutout to the planners or one of the planners of the assassination itself.
Well, he was. My feeling is, and Jim pretty much agreed, or vice versa, that Shaw was probably on the third level. That this thing probably had about six levels, And Shaw was on an operational level, directive level. He had been in military intelligence. He had been probably in French military intelligence while he was in American during the war. That's during World War II. He had connections with military people, intelligent people, all over Europe. So the trial actually fairly well proved, but just not beyond a reasonable doubt, that he was involved. The machinations of the government made some evidence impossible to introduce, and Ferry was on the level below, and Bannister were on the level below Shaw. Shaw was on the level below certain people in Washington, who undoubtedly were under below somebody else, who now still, not that they're still alive, but their replacements are still motivating the policies of the United States and of many countries in the Western world.
We've got about 2 minutes left, Paris, in the interview itself. How would you characterize, how would you sum up the assassination of President Kennedy and what it meant and what it means to America?
I think that the assassination of the president was an invitation to an entirely new form of government. Huey Long, his countryman in terms of state, once said fascism will come to America in the name of anti-fascism, and fascism will come in the name of national security. I think that's pretty much what has happened. Curiously, even before him, Sinclair Lewis said, when fascism comes to America, it will come wrapped in the flag and carrying the cross. And if that doesn't tell listeners something, then they're not listening.
No, indeed. And something that will tell listeners a great deal is the four-volume series, The Assassination of America, about not only the assassination of President Kennedy, but also you talk about this country's other political assassinations. By the way, Paris, you alluded to a couple of the many authors whose work you cite. One was Bill Turner, the author of, among other books, along with Warren Hinkle, The Fish is Red, later reissued under a different title, and also the author with John Christian of The Assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, arguably the best book about that crime. Also Richard Popkin, the author of The Second Oswald. Paris, tell us where people can get your four-volume series, The Assassination of America.
They can write, they can either just email me at all one line, no breaks, assassinationofamerica.com, or they can write to me at my name or at the company name Scanuscription, Scanuscription, at Post Office Box 4848, like the number of states we used to have, Scioto, S-C-I-O-T-A, Pennsylvania, 18354. Any inquiry will send to them all information about how this either the set or the individual last copy, if you already have the first three volumes, can be purchased.
We've been visiting with Paris Flamand, the author of The Kennedy Conspiracy and the just-released four-volume series, The Assassination of America. For Paris Flamand, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening to Side 2 of For the Record, program number 619, interview with Paris Flamand on the anniversary of President Kennedy's assassination. This program is being recorded on November 18th of 2007. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.